I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. These are extraordinary times in cancer research. Recent discoveries about the genetic origins of cancer have led to the development of new ways to predict, detect, and treat this complex disease, and that's fueling new hope that the battle against one of the world's leading killers is winnable. Today on Midday, Dr. Bert Vogelstein, one of the world's leading cancer researchers, talks about the new screening tests that he and his team at Johns Hopkins have developed, and Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal of Kaiser Health News on how these breakthroughs might translate into more accessible and affordable cancer care. Plus, Dr. Amira Woods of the Institute for Policy Studies and Dr. Jalela Manku of the University of Cape Town join me with an appreciation of Winnie Mandela, the anti-apartheid stalwart who died last week. First, the news. Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us for Midday. Coming up a little later today, an appreciation of the South African anti-apartheid activist Winnie Mandela. A memorial service in advance of her official funeral was held today in Soweto, South Africa. But we start today with a conversation about new breakthroughs in cancer research. Nearly 1.7 million people are diagnosed with cancer in the United States every year, and nearly 600,000 of those folks die from the disease. Those who survive often face difficult surgeries and long rounds of chemotherapy, radiation, or costly immunotherapy. Cancer is one of the world's leading killers because it's usually discovered too late, after tumors have grown and spread to other parts of the body. If detected early enough, most cancers would be survivable. But until recently, there have been no reliable early screening methods for the most aggressive forms of cancer. So now, a team of physicians at Johns Hopkins has devised a new kind of blood test that can screen for 8 different kinds of cancer. Taken together, those 8 cancers account for more than 60% of cancer deaths in the United States every year. And that team is led by one of my guests today, Dr. Bert Vogelstein. He is the Clayton Professor of Oncology and Pathology and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and at the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. He's a pioneer in the field of cancer genomics. His research papers have been cited more often than those of any other scientist in any discipline. Dr. Vogelstein, the notable and quotable, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be here. I appreciate it.
And joining us on the line from the studios of Kaiser Health News in Washington is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's a former emergency room physician. She spent 22 years covering health issues for the New York Times. In 2016, she was appointed the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. She's also the author of a terrific book. It's called American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It was published exactly 1 year ago today. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome back to Midday. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Vogelstein, let's talk about genomics. Tell folks what that is.
Sure. Genomics is the science of the genome. The genome represents the code that directs all of our body's functions. It directs all functions of all organisms. It's central to life. And in the past several decades, it has become possible to evaluate in detail the genomes and to understand the exact composition of genomes in virtually all organisms, most importantly, in humans.
And how does that then help us understand and treat cancer?
It helps us understand cancer in the following way. Over the past few decades, once genomic sciences got to the point where they could unravel human genomes, it allowed investigators to determine whether the basis for cancer really was genomic alterations. That was hypothetical when I went to medical school, for example, in the 70s, but it is no longer hypothetical. There has been a true revolution in cancer research from the researcher's perspective, in that we now understand cancer really at the atomic level, at least from a genomic perspective. And I can expand on that a little if you'd like.
Yeah, let me have you do that in a second. But first, let's put this in context. When you began your medical career, you were a pediatrician, weren't you?
Yes.
You now specialize, or at one point you were specializing in colorectal cancers. But there were a bunch of different theories about what caused cancer. And the theory that it's related in the way you've just described to genes was one that you came upon a while ago, and you turned out to be right, and a bunch of other folks turned out to be less right.
I guess one could say that a bunch of folks were right, but the key to being right for all of us who were is the idea that the genetic alterations are responsible. Now, what I mean by a genetic alteration, each of our cells has about 6 billion bases. These are abbreviated as letters, four letters called A, C, G, and T. They are akin to letters in the alphabet, except instead of being 26, there are only four. And when there's a mistake in copying one of those letters when cells divide, it's like a spelling error. So an A is changed to a C, or a T is changed to an A. And that creates a different word. And when the cell reads out the altered code, it can play havoc with it. And to summarize in a few words, the essence of cancer is that there are about three spelling mistakes within these 6 billion bases of DNA that are responsible for the development of virtually all cancers. Now, in different people and different cancers, the spelling mistakes are different. They're not all at the same place. But each person's cancer has roughly just three spelling mistakes. It's basically as simple as that. Now, that doesn't mean it's simple to cure the disease.
Yeah.
But it puts the disease in perspective. We now understand cancer to a degree that was really unimagined several decades ago.
And Dr. Rosenthal, I mean, three spelling mistakes, I reach that level when I'm writing a check, for gosh sakes. It really is quite amazing that Dr. Vogelstein and his team and others in this field have narrowed it down to that. Put in context for us the importance of this approach, the importance of this discovery, and moving forward, where do you think it's going to lead?
Well, for patients, it means more precise diagnosis, and it means more opportunity, in theory, for detecting cancers before they've metastasized or become highly problematic for patients. I guess since I'm always talking about what it feels like for patients or what this means for patients, I guess the question we're seeing more and more, and the question I focus on in my current work is, will it be accessible and affordable for patients, and will it make cancer care better?
And what do you think? What do you think the answer to that is? Yeah.
Well, the answer to that in our current system is always complicated because each new innovation, and there are many wonderful innovations going on, become for some group of people an opportunity for profit and commercialization. And in a country where we're now facing a really unsustainable healthcare bill, I guess the challenge overall is how do we take these wonderful new innovations, which frequently come from the private sector, and there's nothing bad about that particularly, but how do we make sure that they're affordable and usable for people without breaking the bank of either our individual insurance policies or our national health budget?
And Dr. Vogelstein, the thing about cancer is that many of them, if not most of them, are curable as long as physicians can detect it early enough.
That is correct. So as you mentioned before, there are close to about 1.7 million people who develop cancer in the United States and more than 14 million in the world. And in the United States, more than half are cured. And all of them are cured, virtually all of them are cured by surgery. The sad fact is, and this is what the focus of cancer research is today, but the sad fact is, if a cancer is not detected early, if it has already spread through metastasis, then that patient will almost assuredly die. And that is the greatest challenge we face. And hopefully these genetic alterations will lead to reductions in death in two different ways. One, through better treatments, but from my own perspective, I think mainly through better prevention.
And when it comes to prevention, how complicated is the answer to the question, what causes cancer? I suppose in certain areas, it's uncomplicated. If you're a smoker, your risk of lung cancer is higher, that kind of thing. But are there more and more environmental factors or things that people are doing, lifestyle things that people are doing, that are causing this many people, 14 million people worldwide, to get cancer?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, but it can also be answered quite simply. There's a background level of mutations that all our cells suffer. Every time our cells divide, they make about 5 spelling mistakes. That's mutations. Now, most of the vast majority of those spelling mistakes aren't in genes that are important for cancer, but occasionally they are. And sometimes people, non-researchers, ask me, well, why do our cells still make these mistakes after 5 billion years of evolution? You'd think we would have eradicated them, or our cells would have figured out a way. But the answer to that is quite simple. You and I wouldn't be here talking if our cells didn't make mistakes. We would be microorganisms, bacteria, because those mistakes are the engine of evolution. That's how evolution occurs. It's random mistakes made during copying of the DNA. Copying cannot be perfect. And unfortunately, in today's world, especially as individuals live longer, cancer is, in a sense, a side effect of evolution. Those mistakes build up over time during our 60, 70 years, and eventually these 3 spelling errors, these 3 mistakes occur in a cell, leading to a cancer. So that's a baseline source of mutations. Now, unfortunately, people speed up evolution by smoking or exposing themselves to ultraviolet light from the sun, or eating unhealthily, or not exercising enough, or doing all of the kinds of things that we know are correlated with cancer. So certainly many cancers, probably half, can be prevented if one excludes those additional mutations that come from the environment.
And Elizabeth Rosenthal, when we talked about your book, it was last August here on Midday, we talked about the fact that in the United States, we spend roughly $3 trillion a year on healthcare, 20% of our GDP. This is more than twice the average for developing countries. How much of that, those healthcare dollars are going towards the kinds of research that Dr. Vogelstein and the folks in his lab are doing?
Not a lot. I mean, that's treatment money, so that's not counted, really, the kind of research he's doing, you know. And I think the promise of this early detection, there's both promise and peril, and I would love to hear more from Dr. Vogelstein about how this will be used, because the promise of early detection, as he said, is that you find cancers earlier when they're in a much more treatable stage. The peril is that we know that some cancers are very slow growing, or will never metastasize. And will these early genetic tests be able to tell us which of the cancers are dangerous and should we be jumping on them to treat, and which won't cause problems, so we should just tell people not to worry about them? And I think that's been a big issue in prostate cancer. It's been a big issue in DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ. So we see both under-treatment, underutilization of early diagnosis and prevention, and over-treatment of things that are diagnosed early, because at the moment, it's really hard to tell which ones will go on to cause problems. And overtreatment is a, you know, it's a big moneymaker in this country. So people are referred to treatment very quickly who maybe should be told, don't worry. Yes, maybe you have a cancer, but it's not a cancer that will ever kill you.
Yeah, Dr. Vogelstein, what do you think? I mean, it is, it's tricky. If you're detecting these cancers as early as some of your tests have indicated they can do, that could lead to some tough decisions for physicians.
It could lead to tough decisions. But on the other hand, I believe they're manageable. It depends on the way we think of cancers. If a physician tells a patient that they have cancer, the patient's obviously going to be scared and want to be treated. Physician tells the patient not that they have cancer, but they have something worrisome that could grow into a cancer and has to be monitored. That's quite different. So it's not just scientists like me that need to address these issues. It's people like Dr. Rosenthal and many others who think about deeply about the societal impact and how do we present this to patients and what do we do? How can we make cancer less of a dreaded disease and make it something that people can understand? Yes, you may develop cancer. You are at risk, but we're going to track you. We're going to monitor you. And if it develops to a point that we think some sort of therapy is needed, then and only then would therapy be initiated.
Dr. Bert Vogelstein is one of the world's leading researchers in the field of cancer genomics. He's at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. He's also the piano player in a rock band. And Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. We'll have more on the latest medical research into cancer when we come back. 410-662-8780. That's our number, our email, midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, at midday. WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Hey, good afternoon. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to take a look back at Maryland's 2018 General Assembly session. More than 3,100 bills were introduced this year. We'll size up some of the ones that passed and ones that didn't with four Maryland lawmakers who were part of the mix, Republican Senator J.B. Jennings and Democratic Senator Bill Ferguson, as well as Republican Delegate Kathy Shalega and Democratic Delegate Luke Clippinger. Also tomorrow, theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will review Rapture, Blister, Burn. That's the new play at Maryland Ensemble Theater in Frederick. And coming up later today, a conversation about the legacy of South African activist Winnie Mandela, whose memorial service in advance of her official funeral took place today. If you've just joined us, we're talking about some of the latest news in medical and cancer research. Dr. Bert Vogelstein is a specialist in colorectal cancer and an internationally acclaimed pioneer in the field of cancer genomics research at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. And on the line with us from Washington is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and the author of American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. And Dr. Rosenthal, I understand that your book is required reading for a lot of medical students. It's available in paperback. That's great news. Congratulations on this book. It is really done beautifully.
Oh, thank you. I hope it helps medical students. And I hope for patients, it's kind of a user's guide to a often quite confusing and dysfunctional medical system.
Well, I certainly really enjoyed it myself. And as a matter of fact, listeners, we will have a link to my conversation with Elizabeth Rosenthal about her book on our website, wipr.org/midday. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for Bert Vogelstein or Elizabeth Rosenthal, our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle at @midday_WIPR. Dr. Vogelstein, is cancer going to be cured? Are we going to overcome this incredible hurdle?
Well, I guess the first thing to say, and as you well know, cancer is not a single monolithic disease. It's hundreds of different diseases. Are we going to cure it? I wouldn't use the word cure. I think what is possible to be done in the intermediate future is to reduce cancer deaths by 3/4. And over the last half century, for example, deaths from heart disease have been reduced by that same figure, 75%. Unfortunately, cancer deaths have not declined virtually at all. And part, I believe, of the reason for this incredible discrepancy between heart disease and cancer is that the focus of heart disease research, as well as implementation, has been prevention rather than treatment. If a person today has a massive heart attack or a massive stroke, they are going to die. And they're no less likely to die now than they would have been 50 years ago. But the saving grace is many fewer people have massive heart attacks because of these prevention measures, primary or secondary prevention measures. So we can't cure heart disease, and I don't think we'll ever be able to, in a sense, cure or eradicate cancer. But I think it's quite feasible that we'll be able to reduce the suffering and deaths from cancer to a great extent. And the history of medical research makes me very optimistic about that. Once you understand a disease, it's only a matter of time before you can do something about it. And as we discussed before, we now really do understand a lot about cancer.
And Dr. Rosenthal, in terms of the research that's being done at places like Johns Hopkins, which is a putatively nonprofit, you know, teaching hospital, as opposed mm-hmm. to private researchers, what's the mix between public and private research? And is it, to your reckoning, the right mix? Are there things that we need to do to change the way that cancer research is funded and approached?
Well, I'm always a fan of more public funding rather than private funding, because I think the big issue that people with cancer face today, aside from the cancer, is, I mean, the treatments have gotten much better, but they're also, even compared to heart treatments, they're fantastically expensive. A lot of the new cancer treatments are coming on the market now, like the CAR T therapies, you know, $500,000. And since cancer is often, as Dr. Vogelsein said, it's not cured, but kind of turned into a chronic management issue. Those are not often one-time costs, but they're, you know, year after year after year. And a lot of that, I think, in some ways comes out of the fact that we rely on the private sector to come up with new drugs and treatments, and they put whatever price they want to on those miraculous new drugs and treatments. And, you know, the result, sadly, is I hear from a lot of people who are cancer survivors or living with cancer who can't pay their bills, who there was one alarming survey out of Oregon that I think 3% of people with cancer in the U.S. had to declare bankruptcy. You know, and that doesn't count all the people who, you know, have sold their houses to pay for their treatments. And these are sometimes people with insurance, right? Some of the newer drugs, maybe they're not covered, or maybe because they're $500,000 a year, the insurer puts them in a higher tier with a very high copayment. It's really a struggle. Like, the number of people who facing cancer are now forced at the same time to face extreme economic hardship. You know, we're not talking about a $500 copay. We're talking about finding $20,000 for treatment that you need year after year after year. So I think more public funding of that research would be helpful. Or even when cures come out of the private sector, saying more discussion, negotiation, maybe even regulation of what price can be charged for these truly life-saving, miraculous treatments.
And Dr. Vogelsein, let's talk a little bit about the work that you and your colleagues in the lab at Hopkins have developed. You have these SEEK tests, which allow cancer to be identified through a blood test. How does it work?
Yes, the SEEK tests, S-E-E-K, are based on trying to find evidence for these genetic alterations, which only occur in cancer cells and various bodily fluids. And the conceptual rationale for all these tests is really the experience with pap smears. George's Papanicolaou, close to 100 years ago, invented a test now called the pap test, or pap smear, for cervical cancer. And that test is now routinely given to women. It's a simple scraping of the cervix and a microscopic evaluation. And if there are abnormal cells there, it indicates that the patient might have cancer. And if when that test has been administered to populations, it has reduced deaths from cervical cancer by close to 90%. So such secondary prevention strategies, that is, detecting cancers early, clearly can work. Other successes are in colonoscopy and to a certain extent, mammography. These tests have the same conceptual rationale, but they're technically more sophisticated. They're based on detecting the genetic alterations, mutations, that are unique to cancers. And in fact, one of these tests, called the PAP-seq test, actually uses the fluid that is currently now used for screening for cervical cancer. But instead of looking at the cells from the fluid under the microscope, we look for mutations in DNA purified from those fluids. And that allows us to detect other cancers of in women, particularly endometrial, that is uterine cancers, and to a certain extent, ovarian cancers.
Whereas a pap smear test would only detect cervical cancer.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting that now uterine cancers cause more deaths in the United States than cervical cancers, the exact opposite of what occurred before pap smears were introduced. So we hope that tests like these, applied either to pap smear fluids, applied to urine to detect bladder cancer, applied to blood to detect a variety of cancers, can eventually allow physicians to detect cancers at an early stage, and therefore allow patients to survive these diseases.
And, of course, a blood test, a urine test, very non-invasive, very easy to administer. There are 8 cancers that these tests can detect: liver, stomach, pancreatic, ovarian, esophageal, colon, lung, and breast cancer. But as you mentioned, there are hundreds of cancers. So or are those other kinds of cancers going to require different iterations of this basic approach?
Yeah, I would say that this particular test called CancerSeek, it actually detects more than 8 cancers. Mm-hmm. We only used it in our research to evaluate 8 cancers.
And what's the status of that research? Is this a test that's soon to be available to patients?
No, this is a research-based test. We've so far applied it to about 1,000 patients with cancers and a similar number of normal individuals. The next step in this research, which is ongoing now, is a clinical trial in which many thousands, tens of thousands of individuals who are believed to be healthy take the test, and we prospectively evaluate whether the test will actually be able to point to early cancers in those patients. And it will only be after such very controlled, rigorous clinical studies are undertaken that we would even consider offering the test on a commercial
basis.
And
at this point, you probably can't speculate as to how expensive this will be.
Yes, we can speculate on that, and that's very important. We think that in order for a test to be applicable to the general population, the cost can't be much more than about $500. Mm-hmm. And that cost is comparable to other successful screening tests that are more invasive, for example, colonoscopy, which can detect colon or rectal cancer. This kind of test could, in theory, detect many more.
And Elizabeth Rosenthal, how does that sit with you in terms of that price range for a test like this?
You know, seems like a pretty good deal compared to what's out there. I think the thing that I'll be watching, it's fascinating research, is what's the rate of false positives? Because as you know, what we see, which is often very problematic in cancer screening, is that a false positive set off these very elaborate test or need for follow-up testing to see what it means. And sometimes it will mean nothing. So if you have a false positive and you end up spending $10,000 and getting invasive, dangerous procedures to follow up on something that wasn't a problem, you've wasted a lot of money and also endangered your health. The other issue is sometimes these disruptive screening techniques or disruptive techniques in medicine are resisted very aggressively by the financial interests that are out there. So I'm sure Dr. Vogelstein knows there's also another kind of newer test for screening for colon cancer that is an alternative to colonoscopy, which is an invasive procedure. As all of us know, it can be very unpleasant. If you're older or frail, those clean-outs the night before can be really risky. There's a stool test called, I think it's commercially called Cologuard.
Yeah, well, I've seen that advertised on television even.
Right. And, you know, they've had a hard time getting it into doctors' hands because it disrupts or getting doctors to use it, in part because it disrupts a big industry of colonoscopies, which a lot of people are making a lot of money for. So, you know, again, there will be two different kinds of issues. One is, is it finding things that are important and that we can act on and that we should act on, or is it just causing people to worry needlessly and undergo needless and expensive tests?
Yeah, what do you think, Doctor?
Second,
I'm sorry, Elizabeth. Continue, please. Yeah.
Uh-huh. No, and you know, will the medical world accept something that may save money overall, but reduce its own income?
What do you think, Dr. Vogelstein?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more and have some experience that I think Dr. Rosenthal will appreciate. That test, Cologuard, was based on research done in our lab. It was licensed from Johns Hopkins to Exact Sciences. So I know the whole history of what they went through to actually get the commercial test. And what I found fascinating was when we were discussing the economics of it, and we were talking to health maintenance organizations, we were informed that it wasn't economically feasible for them to do screening tests for a reason that I had never even imagined would be true. And that is, they told us that when they do screening, it saves money in the long term. But the patients who would get cancer, by the time they get cancer, would have migrated off their plan into another health maintenance.
So, well, if that ain't twisting yourself into a pretzel, I don't know what is.
Right. So, so that's why, you know, from an individual insurance company or HMO, it doesn't make sense economically to do screening. But from the whole country's perspective, that's very different.
Is it as accurate as a colonoscopy if you take this Cologuard test at home as opposed to going for the procedure?
Well, it is very sensitive in the sense that it detects about 90% of cancers. It's not as specific in that that many of the cases it detects do not have cancer. In fact, most don't. The reason it's okay, in a sense, is because if there's a result that's a false positive, the only thing that ensues is colonoscopy, which is recommended anyway. Mm. So it saves a lot of people from having to undergo colonoscopies. And is tolerable because the follow-up, which Dr. Rosenthal mentioned before, it is not horrible. It's just a colonoscopy.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Marie in Catonsville, welcome to Midday with Dr. Bert Vogelstein and Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal.
Hi. I had a question about when you're counting the numbers of people that have died of cancer, because are you actually counting the people that have died of the cancer or that have died of complications or have died of the chemo drugs? My mother actually passed away because the drug crystallized her lungs. She was beating the cancer, and it was the drug that killed her. So when you're talking about wanting to reduce the numbers, what is it you're really looking at?
Well, thank you for your call, and I'm so sorry for your loss, Marie. So, Dr. Vogelstein, people do die of ancillary issues related to their treatment, I guess. Huh?
Yes. The numbers that you quoted before at the beginning of the show, those deaths, about 600,000, those were deaths from cancer or complications of cancer, including deaths from treatment. That's the way the American Cancer Society figures them.
Dr. Rosenthal, when it comes to the way we spend our money in the United States as opposed to, you know, England or places in Europe, for example, something like the flu vaccine. I understand that the flu vaccine, which we have administered, you know, in drugstores and in clinics and hospitals here in the United States, in England and in Europe, it's administered in a different way, and I guess it's less expensive.
Well, not always, but in some countries, and I don't know about England, I know when I lived in Italy, I went to the pharmacy, got a flu vaccine because I knew I needed one. It was not something I needed a physician to prescribe for me, and my husband and I gave it to ourselves at home. You know, a lot of these shots are very easy to give, and maybe why don't need a prescription or a health professional to be involved. So there are cheaper ways to do much of what we do in the U.S. in more expensive ways. Likewise, when we're talking about cancer treatment, I mean, what we see in the way of really high prescription drug prices in this country relative to the rest of the world has a huge impact. I mean, when you look at the price of cancer care, much of that is the price of those new cancer drugs. And what you see when you look at those new cancer drugs is that, and old cancer drugs, is that we in the U.S. Often pay 2, 3, 4, even 10 times as much as people in many of the European countries. So I think both with little things like vaccines and with big things like life-saving cancer drugs, which we see advertised on TV every night, we have to ask, why do we do things so differently and pay so much more than people in the rest of the world? And could we improve our overall health by learning some lessons from them?
And we will continue to ask questions just like that as we continue to monitor the work that both of you are doing. I'm very grateful to both of you for spending time with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. She reported about medical issues for the New York Times for more than 20 years. Her book is a terrific one. I highly recommend it. It's called American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Dr. Bert Vogelstein is one of the world's leading researchers in the field of cancer genomics at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. Drs. Vogelstein and Rosenthal will be featured in an upcoming discussion on medical research that's part of this year's Great Talk series. They'll be at the Maryland Science Center on Tuesday, April 24th. The panel's entitled Truths, Myths, and Breakthroughs in Medical and Cancer Research. We've got a link to that event at WIPR.org/midday. Coming up after a quick break, an appreciation of Winnie Mandela. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. These are extraordinary times in cancer research. Recent discoveries about the genetic origins of cancer have led to the development of new ways to predict, detect, and treat this complex disease, and that's fueling new hope that the battle against one of the world's leading killers is winnable. Today on Midday, Dr. Bert Vogelstein, one of the world's leading cancer researchers, talks about the new screening tests that he and his team at Johns Hopkins have developed, and Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal of Kaiser Health News on how these breakthroughs might translate into more accessible and affordable cancer care. Plus, Dr. Amira Woods of the Institute for Policy Studies and Dr. Jalela Manku of the University of Cape Town join me with an appreciation of Winnie Mandela, the anti-apartheid stalwart who died last week. First, the news. Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us for Midday. Coming up a little later today, an appreciation of the South African anti-apartheid activist Winnie Mandela. A memorial service in advance of her official funeral was held today in Soweto, South Africa. But we start today with a conversation about new breakthroughs in cancer research. Nearly 1.7 million people are diagnosed with cancer in the United States every year, and nearly 600,000 of those folks die from the disease. Those who survive often face difficult surgeries and long rounds of chemotherapy, radiation, or costly immunotherapy. Cancer is one of the world's leading killers because it's usually discovered too late, after tumors have grown and spread to other parts of the body. If detected early enough, most cancers would be survivable. But until recently, there have been no reliable early screening methods for the most aggressive forms of cancer. Now, a team of physicians at Johns Hopkins has devised a new kind of blood test that can screen for 8 different kinds of cancer. Taken together, those 8 cancers account for more than 60% of cancer deaths in the United States every year. And that team is led by one of my guests today, Dr. Bert Vogelstein. He is the Clayton Professor of Oncology and Pathology and a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and at the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. He's a pioneer in the field of cancer genomics. His research papers have been cited more often than those of any other scientist in any discipline. Dr. Vogelstein, the notable and quotable, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be here. I appreciate it.
And joining us on the line from the studios of Kaiser Health News in Washington is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's a former emergency room physician. She spent 22 years covering health issues for the New York Times. In 2016, she was appointed the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. She's also the author of a terrific book. It's called American Sickness: How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. It was published exactly 1 year ago today. Dr. Rosenthal, welcome back to Midday. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Vogelstein, let's talk about genomics. Tell folks what that is.
Sure. Genomics is the science of the genome. The genome represents the code that directs all of our body's functions. It directs all functions of all organisms. It's central to life. And in the past several decades, it has become possible to evaluate in detail the genomes and to understand the exact composition of genomes in virtually all organisms, most importantly, in humans.
And how does that then help us understand and treat cancer?
It helps us understand cancer in the following way. Over the past few decades, once genomic sciences got to the point where they could unravel human genomes, it allowed investigators to determine whether the basis for cancer really was genomic alterations. That was hypothetical when I went to medical school, for example, in the 70s, but it is no longer hypothetical. There has been a true revolution in cancer research from the researcher's perspective, in that we now understand cancer really at the atomic level, at least from a genomic perspective. And I can expand on that a little if you'd like.
Yeah, let me have you do that in a second. But first, let's put this in context. When you began your medical career, you were a pediatrician, weren't you?
Yes.
You now specialize, or at one point you were specializing in colorectal cancers. But there were a bunch of different theories about what caused cancer. And the theory that it's related in the way you've just described to genes was one that you came upon a while ago, and you turned out to be right, and a bunch of other folks turned out to be less right.
I guess one could say that a bunch of folks were right, but the key to being right for all of us who were is the idea that the genetic alterations are responsible. Now, what I mean by a genetic alteration, each of our cells has about 6 billion bases. These are abbreviated as letters, 4 letters called A, C, G, and T. They are akin to letters in the alphabet, except instead of being 26, there are only 4. And when there's a mistake in copying one of those letters when cells divide, it's like a spelling error. So an A is changed to a C, or a T is changed to an A. And that creates a different word. And when the cell reads out the altered code, it can play havoc with it. And to summarize in a few words, the essence of cancer is that there are about 3 spelling mistakes within these 6 billion bases of DNA that are responsible for the development of virtually all cancers. Now, in different people and different cancers, the spelling mistakes are different. They're not all at the same place. But each person's cancer has roughly just 3 spelling mistakes. It's basically as simple as that. Now, that doesn't mean it's simple to cure the disease.
Yeah.
But it puts the disease in perspective. We now understand cancer to a degree that was really unimagined several decades ago.
And Dr. Rosenthal, I mean, 3 spelling mistakes, I reach that level when I'm writing a check, for gosh sakes. It really is quite amazing that Dr. Vogelstein and his team and others in this field have narrowed it down to that. Put in context for us the importance of this approach, the importance of this discovery, and moving forward, where do you think it's going to lead?
Well, for patients, it means more precise diagnosis, and it means more opportunity, in theory, for detecting cancers before they've metastasized or become highly problematic for patients. I guess since I'm always talking about what it feels like for patients or what this means for patients, I guess the question we're seeing more and more, and the question I focus on in my current work is, will it be accessible and affordable for patients, and will it make cancer care better?
And what do you think? What do you think the answer to that is? Yeah.
Well, the answer to that in our current system is always complicated because each new innovation, and there are many wonderful innovations going on, become for some group of people an opportunity for profit and commercialization. And in a country where we're now facing a really unsustainable healthcare bill, I guess the challenge overall is how do we take these wonderful new innovations, which frequently come from the private sector, and there's nothing bad about that particularly, but how do we make sure that they're affordable and usable for people without breaking the bank of either our individual insurance policies or our national health budget?
And Dr. Vogelstein, the thing about cancer is that many of them, if not most of them, are curable as long as physicians can detect it early enough.
That is correct. So as you mentioned before, there are close to about 1.7 million people who develop cancer in the United States and more than 14 million in the world. And in the United States, more than half are cured. And all of them are cured, virtually all of them are cured by surgery. The sad fact is, and this is what the focus of cancer research is today, but the sad fact is, if a cancer is not detected early, if it has already spread through metastasis, then that patient will almost assuredly die. And that is the greatest challenge we face. And hopefully these genetic alterations will lead to reductions in death in two different ways. One, through better treatments, but from my own perspective, I think mainly through better prevention.
And when it comes to prevention, how complicated is the answer to the question, what causes cancer? I suppose in certain areas, it's uncomplicated. If you're a smoker, your risk of lung cancer is higher, that kind of thing. But more and more environmental factors or things that people are doing, lifestyle things that people are doing that are causing this many people, 14 million people worldwide to get cancer?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, but it can also be answered quite simply. There's a background level of mutations that all our cells suffer. Every time our cells divide, they make about 5 spelling mistakes. That's mutations. Now, the vast majority of those spelling mistakes aren't in genes that are important for cancer, but occasionally they are. And sometimes people, non-researchers, ask me, well, why do our cells still make these mistakes after 5 billion years of evolution? You'd think we would have eradicated them or our cells would have figured out a way. But the answer to that is quite simple. You and I wouldn't be here talking if our cells didn't make mistakes. We would be microorganisms, bacteria, because those mistakes are the engine of evolution. That's how evolution occurs. It's random mistakes made during copying of the DNA. Copying cannot be perfect. And unfortunately, in today's world, especially as individuals live longer, cancer is, in a sense, a side effect of evolution. Those mistakes build up over time during our 60, 70 years, and eventually these 3 spelling errors, these 3 mistakes occur in a cell, leading to a cancer. So that's a baseline source of mutations. Now, unfortunately, people speed up evolution by smoking or exposing themselves to ultraviolet light from the sun, or eating unhealthily, or not exercising enough, or doing all of the kinds of things that we know are correlated with cancer. So certainly many cancers, probably half, can be prevented if one excludes those additional mutations that come from the environment.
And Elizabeth Rosenthal, when we talked about your book, it was last August here on Midday, we talked about the fact that in the United States, we spend roughly $3 trillion a year on healthcare, 20% of our GDP. This is more than twice the average for developing countries. How much of that, those healthcare dollars are going towards the kinds of research that Dr. Vogelstein and the folks in his lab are doing?
Not a lot. I mean, that's treatment money, so that's not counted, really, the kind of research he's doing, you know. And I think the promise of this early detection, there's both promise and peril, and I would love to hear more from Dr. Vogelstein about how this will be used, because the promise of early detection, as he said, is that you find cancers earlier when they're in a much more treatable stage. The peril is that we know that some cancers are very slow growing, or will never metastasize, and will these early genetic tests be able to tell us which of the cancers are dangerous and should we be jumping on them to treat, and which won't cause problems, so we should just tell people not to worry about them? And I think that's been a big issue in prostate cancer. It's been a big issue in DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ. So we see both under-treatment, underutilization of early diagnosis and prevention, and over-treatment of things that are diagnosed early, because at the moment, it's really hard to tell which ones will go on to cause problems. And over-treatment is it's a big moneymaker in this country. So people are referred to treatment very quickly who maybe should be told, don't worry. Yes, maybe you have a cancer, but it's not a cancer that will ever kill you.
Yeah, Dr. Vogelstein, what do you think? I mean, it is it's tricky. If you're detecting these cancers as early as some of your tests have indicated they can do, that could lead to some tough decisions for physicians.
It could lead to tough decisions. But on the other hand, I believe they're manageable. It depends on the way we think of cancers. If a physician tells a patient that they have cancer, the patient's obviously going to be scared and want to be treated. Physician tells the patient not that they have cancer, but they have something worrisome that could grow into a cancer and has to be monitored. That's quite different. So it's not just scientists like me that need to address these issues. It's people like Dr. Rosenthal and many others who think about deeply about the societal impact and how do we present this to patients and what do we do? How can we make cancer less of a dreaded disease and make it something that people can understand? Yes, you may develop cancer, you are at risk, but we're going to track you, we're going to monitor you, and if it develops to a point that we think some sort of therapy is needed, then and only then would therapy be initiated.
Dr. Bert Vogelstein is one of the world's leading researchers in the field of cancer genomics. He's at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. He's also the piano player in a rock band. And Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. We'll have more on the latest medical research into cancer when we come back. 410-662-8780. That's our number, our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And good afternoon. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to take a look back at Maryland's 2018 General Assembly session. More than 3,100 bills were introduced this year. We'll size up some of the ones that passed and ones that didn't with four Maryland lawmakers who were part of the mix, Republican Senator J.B. Jennings and Democratic Senator Bill Ferguson, as well as Republican Delegate Kathy Shalega and Democratic Delegate Luke Clippinger. Also tomorrow, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Rapture, Blister, Burn. That's the new play at Maryland Ensemble Theater in Frederick. And coming up later today, a conversation about the legacy of South African activist Winnie Mandela, whose memorial service in advance of her official funeral took place today. If you've just joined us, we're talking about some of the latest news in medical and cancer research. Dr. Bert Vogelstein is a specialist in colorectal cancer and an internationally acclaimed pioneer in the field of cancer genomics research at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. And on the line with us from Washington is Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and the author of American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. And Dr. Rosenthal, I understand that your book is required reading for a lot of medical students. It's available in paperback. That's great news. Congratulations on this book. It has really done beautifully.
Oh, thank you. I hope it helps medical students, and I hope for patients it's kind of a user's guide to a often quite confusing and dysfunctional medical system.
Well, I certainly really enjoyed it myself, and as a matter of fact, listeners, we will have a link to my conversation with Elizabeth Rosenthal about her book on our website, wypr.org/midday. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question for Bert Vogelstein or Elizabeth Rosenthal, our number, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. Dr. Vogelstein, is cancer going to be cured? Are we going to overcome this incredible hurdle?
I guess the first thing to say, and as you well know, cancer is not a single monolithic disease. It's hundreds of different diseases. Are we going to cure it? I wouldn't use the word cure. I think what is possible to be done in the intermediate future is to reduce cancer deaths by 3/4. And over the last half century, for example, deaths from heart disease have been reduced by that same figure, 75%. Unfortunately, cancer deaths have not declined virtually at all. And part, I believe, of the reason for this incredible discrepancy between heart disease and cancer is that the focus of heart disease research, as well as implementation, has been prevention rather than treatment. If a person today has a massive heart attack or a massive stroke, they're going to die. And they're no less likely to die now than they would have been 50 years ago. But the saving grace is many fewer people have massive heart attacks because of these prevention measures, primary or secondary prevention measures. So we can't cure heart disease, and I don't think we'll ever be able to, in a sense, cure or eradicate cancer. But I think it's quite feasible that we'll be able to reduce the suffering and deaths from cancer to a great extent. And the history of medical research makes me very optimistic about that. Once you understand a disease, it's only a matter of time before you can do something about it. And as we discussed before, we now really do understand a lot about cancer.
And Dr. Rosenthal, in terms of the research that's being done at places like Johns Hopkins, which is a putatively nonprofit, you know, teaching hospital, as opposed mm-hmm. to private researchers, what's the mix between public and private research? And is it, to your reckoning, the right mix? Are there things that we need to do to change the way that cancer research is funded and approached?
Well, I'm always a fan of more public funding rather than private funding, because I think the big issue that people with cancer face today, aside from the cancer, is, I mean, the treatments have gotten much better, but they're also, even compared to heart treatments, they're fantastically expensive. A lot of the new cancer treatments are coming on the market now, like the CAR-T therapies, you know, $500,000. And since cancer is often, as Dr. Vogelsang said, it's not cured, but kind of turned into a chronic management issue. Those are not often one-time costs, but they're, you know, year after year after year. And a lot of that, I think, in some ways comes out of the fact that we rely on the private sector to come up with new drugs and treatments, and they put whatever price they want to on those miraculous new drugs and treatments. And, you know, the result, sadly, is I hear from a lot of people who are cancer survivors or living with cancer who can't pay their bills, who there was one alarming survey out of Oregon that I think 3% of people with cancer in the U.S. had to declare bankruptcy. You know, and that doesn't count all the people who, you know, have sold their houses to pay for their treatments. And these are sometimes people with insurance, right? Some of the newer drugs, maybe they're not covered, or maybe because they're $500,000 a year, the insurer puts them in a higher tier with a very high copayment. It's really a struggle. Like, the number of people who facing cancer are now forced at the same time to face extreme economic hardship. You know, we're not talking about a $500 copay. We're talking about finding $20,000 for treatment that you need year after year after year. So I think more public funding of that research would be helpful. Or even when cures come out of the private sector, saying more discussion, negotiation, maybe even regulation of what price can be charged for these truly life-saving, miraculous treatments.
And Dr. Vogelsang, let's talk a little bit about the work that you and your colleagues in the lab at Hopkins have developed. You have these SEEK tests, which allow cancer to be identified through a blood test. How does it work?
Yes, the SEEK tests, S-E-E-K, are based on trying to find evidence for these genetic alterations, which only occur in cancer cells in various bodily fluids. And the conceptual rationale for all these tests is really the experience with pap smears. George's Papanicolaou, close to 100 years ago, invented a test now called the pap test or pap smear for cervical cancer. And that that test is now routinely given to women. It's a simple scraping of the cervix and a microscopic evaluation. And if there are abnormal cells there, it indicates that the patient might have cancer. And if and when that test has been administered to populations, it has reduced deaths from cervical cancer by close to 90%. So such secondary prevention strategies, that is, detecting cancers early, clearly can work. Other successes are in colonoscopy and to a certain extent, mammography. These tests have the same conceptual rationale, but they're technically more sophisticated. They're based on detecting the genetic alterations, mutations, that are unique to cancers. And in fact, one of these tests, called the PAP-seq test, actually uses the fluid that is currently now used for screening for cervical cancer. But instead of looking at the cells from the fluid under the microscope, we look for mutations in DNA purified from those fluids. And that allows us to detect other cancers of in women, particularly endometrial, that is uterine cancers, and to a certain extent, ovarian cancers.
Whereas a pap smear test would only detect cervical cancer.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting that now uterine cancers cause more deaths in the United States than cervical cancers, the exact opposite of what occurred before pap smears were introduced. So we hope that tests like these applied either to pap smear fluids, applied to urine to detect bladder cancer, applied to blood to detect a variety of cancers, can eventually allow physicians to detect cancers at an early stage, and therefore allow patients to survive these diseases.
And of course, a blood test, a urine test, very non-invasive, very easy to
Correct.
Administer. There are 8 cancers that these tests can detect: liver, stomach, pancreatic, ovarian, esophageal, colon, lung, and breast cancer. But as you mentioned, there are hundreds of cancers. So or are those other kinds of cancers going to require different iterations of this basic approach?
Yeah, I would say that this particular test called CancerSeq, it actually detects more than 8 cancers. Mm-hmm. We only used it in our research to evaluate 8 cancers.
And what's the status of that research? Is this a test that's soon to be available to patients?
No, this is a research-based test. We've so far applied it to about 1,000 patients with cancers and a similar number of normal individuals. The next step in this research, which is ongoing now, is a clinical trial in which many thousands, tens of thousands of individuals who are believed to be healthy take the test, and we prospectively evaluate whether the test will actually be able to point to early cancers in those patients. And it will only be after such very controlled, rigorous clinical studies are undertaken that we would even consider offering the test on a commercial
basis.
And
at this point, you probably can't speculate as to how expensive this will be.
Yes, we can speculate on mm-hmm. that, and that's very important. We think that in order for a test to be applicable to the general population, the cost can't be much more than about $500. Mm-hmm. And that cost is comparable to other successful screening tests that are more invasive. For example, colonoscopy, which can detect colon or rectal cancer. This kind of test could, in theory, detect many more.
And Elizabeth Rosenthal, how does that sit with you in terms of that price range for a test like this?
You know, seems like a pretty good deal compared to what's out there. I think the thing that I'll be watching, it's fascinating research, is, you know, A, what's the rate of false positives, because as you know, what we see, which is often very problematic in cancer screening, is that a false positive set off these very elaborate test or need for follow-up testing to see what it means. And often it will, sometimes it will mean nothing. So if you have a false positive and you end up spending $10,000 and getting invasive, dangerous procedures to follow up on something that wasn't a problem, you've wasted a lot of money and also endangered your health. The other issue is sometimes these disruptive screening techniques or disruptive techniques in medicine are resisted very aggressively by the financial interests that are out there. So I'm sure Dr. Vogelstein knows there's also another kind of newer test for screening for colon cancer that is an alternative to colonoscopy, which is an invasive procedure. As all of us know, it can be very unpleasant. If you're older or frail, those clean-outs the night before can be really risky. There's a stool test called I think it's commercially called Cologuard.
Yeah, well, I've seen that advertised on television even.
Right. And, you know, they've had a hard time getting it into doctors' hands because it disrupts or getting doctors to use it, in part because it disrupts a big industry of colonoscopies, which a lot of people are making a lot of money for. So, you know, again, there will be two different kinds of issues. One is it finding things that are important and that we can act on and that we should act on, or is it just causing people to worry needlessly and undergo needless and expensive tests?
Yeah, what do you
think,
Dr.? Second, I'm sorry, Elizabeth, continue, please. Yeah.
No, and you know, will the medical world accept something that may save money overall but reduce its own income?
What do you think, Dr. Vogelstein?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree more and have some experience that I think Dr. Rosenthal will appreciate. That test, Cologuard, was based on research done in our lab. It was licensed from Johns Hopkins to Exact Sciences. So I know the whole history of what they went through to actually get the commercial test. And one of the what I found fascinating was when we were discussing the economics of it, and we were talking to health maintenance organizations, we were informed that it wasn't economically feasible for them to do screening tests for a reason that I had never even imagined would be true. And that is, they told us that when they do screening, it saves money in the long term. But the patients who would get cancer, by the time they get cancer, would have migrated off their plan into another health maintenance.
So, well, if that ain't twisting yourself into a pretzel, I don't know what is.
Right. So, so that's why, you know, from an individual insurance company or HMO, it doesn't make sense economically to do screening. But from the whole country's perspective, that's very different.
Is it as accurate as a colonoscopy if you take this Cologuard test at home as opposed to going for the procedure?
Well, it is very sensitive in the sense that it detects about 90% of cancers. It's not as specific in that that many of the cases it detects do not have cancer. In fact, most don't. The reason it's okay, in a sense, is because if there's a result that's a false positive, the only thing that ensues is colonoscopy, which is recommended anyway. Mm. So it saves a lot of people from having to undergo colonoscopies. And is tolerable because the follow-up, which Dr. Rosenthal mentioned before, is not horrible. It's just a colonoscopy.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Marie in Catonsville, welcome to Midday with Dr. Bert Vogelstein and Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal.
Hi. I had a question about when you're counting the numbers of people that have died of cancer, because are you actually counting the people that have died of the cancer or that have died of complications or have died of the keynote drugs?
My mother actually passed away because the drug crystallized her lungs. She was beating the cancer, and it was the drug that killed her. So when you're talking about wanting to reduce the numbers, what is it you're really looking at?
Well, thank you for your call, and I'm so sorry for your loss, Marie. So, Dr. Bogelstein, people do die of ancillary issues related to their treatment, I guess. Huh?
Yes. The numbers that you quoted before at the beginning of the show, those deaths, about 600,000, those were deaths from cancer or complications of cancer, including deaths from treatment. That's the way the American Cancer Society figures them.
Dr. Rosenthal, when it comes to the way we spend our money in the United States as opposed to, you know, England or places in Europe, for example, something like the flu vaccine. I understand that the flu vaccine, which we have administered, you know, in drugstores and in clinics and hospitals here in the United States, in England and in Europe, it's administered in a different way, and I guess it's less expensive.
Well, not always, but in some countries, and I don't know about England, I know when I lived in Italy, I went to the pharmacy, got a flu vaccine because I knew I needed one. It was not something I needed a physician to prescribe for me. And my husband and I gave it to ourselves at home. You know, a lot of these shots are very easy to give. And maybe why don't need a prescription or a health professional to be involved. So there are cheaper ways to do much of what we do in the U.S. in more expensive ways. Likewise, when we're talking about cancer treatment, I mean, what we see in the way of really high prescription drug prices in this country relative to the rest of the world has a huge impact. I mean, when you look at the price of cancer care, much of that is the price of those new cancer drugs. And what you see when you look at those new cancer drugs is that, and old cancer drugs, is that we in the U.S. Often pay 2, 3, 4, even 10 times as much as people in many of the European countries. So I think both with little things like vaccines and with big things like life-saving cancer drugs, which we see advertised on TV every night, we have to ask, why do we do things so differently and pay so much more than people in the rest of the world? And could we improve our overall health by learning some lessons from them?
And we will continue to ask questions just like that as we continue to monitor the work that both of you are doing. And I'm very grateful to both of you for spending time with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. She reported about medical issues for the New York Times for more than 20 years. Her book is a terrific one. I highly recommend it. It's called American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Dr. Bert Vogelstein is one of the world's leading researchers in the field of cancer genomics at the Johns Hopkins Medical School and the Sidney Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center here in Baltimore. Drs. Vogelstein and Rosenthal will be featured in an upcoming discussion on medical research that's part of this year's Great Talk series. They'll be at the Maryland Science Center on Tuesday, April 24th. The panel's entitled Truths, Myths, and Breakthroughs in Medical and Cancer Research. We've got a link to that event at WIPR.org/midday. Coming up after a quick break, an appreciation of Winnie Mandela. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.